This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to AM. I'm Kim Landers. On the program today, the international investigation into the origins of the coronavirus pandemic finally gets underway in China. And desperate families plead for the relaxation of visa rules requiring them to temporarily leave the country.
Firstly, you've got the worry of the COVID situation. And secondly, you've got the worry of being stranded somewhere else. And then obviously we would have to come back in and quarantine with the cost and the expense and the trauma that involves when we're actually here safe and sound now.
A week ago, the US Capitol building was under attack by an angry mob. Today, the House of Representatives is voting to impeach Donald Trump for a second time. With just a week before he leaves office, the president is facing a charge of inciting an insurrection. And with reports of more demonstrations being planned, President Trump has this morning issued a statement calling for calm, saying there must be no violence, no law-breaking, and no vandalism of any kind. North America correspondent Catherine Diss reports from Washington.
House will be in order.
Returning to a heavily fortified Capitol building protected by thousands of National Guard troops.
Speaker, we are debating this historic measure at an actual crime scene, and we wouldn't be here if it weren't for the President of the United States.
Congress, for the second time in 13 months, embarking on the journey of bringing the most serious political charge against a sitting president.
Donald John Trump thus warrants impeachment and trial, removal from office, and disqualification to hold and enjoy any office of honor, trust, or profit under the United States.
The impeachment article accuses Donald Trump of inciting an insurrection, which led to the deadly rampage by his loyal supporters last week, derailing the confirmation of Joe Biden's election win.
He must go. He is a clear and present danger to the nation that we all love.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi opening debate on the House floor.
It gives me no pleasure to say this. It breaks my heart. It should break your heart. It should break all of our hearts.
Unlike last time, Republican support for the president is fraying at the edges. Several so far have shown their hand in support. The number who vote could be higher. Republican Adam Kinzinger among the defectors.
We live in the time right now where there are people that are willing to take violence to members of Congress because of a political view or because they have been brainwashed some to the point to believe that this is the end of their life in a democratic republic because they've been told that.
And according to the New York Times, even the most powerful man in the Senate, Mitch McConnell, is said to back the move. Democrat Omar Alan urged those on the other side of the aisle to fall in line.
We have been asked to turn a blind eye to the criminality, corruption, and blatant disregard to the rule of law by the tyrant president we have in the White House.
But like much in this country, opinion over firing the gun on the Constitution's gravest remedy remains divided. One of the president's most ardent backers, Republican Jim Jordan.
This doesn't unite the country. There's no way this helps the nation deal with the tragic and terrible events of last week that we all condemn. And Republicans have been consistent. We've condemned all the violence all the time. We condemned it last summer. We condemned it last week. We should be focused on bringing the nation together. Instead, Democrats are going to impeach the president for a second time, one week before he leaves office.
Here's House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy.
That doesn't mean the president is free from fault. The president bears responsibility for Wednesday's attack on Congress by mob rioters. He should have immediately denounced the mob when he saw what was unfolding. These facts require immediate action by President Trump. Accept his share of responsibility. Quell the brewing unrest. And ensure President-elect Biden is able to successfully begin his term.
The vote has got underway. It's likely to pass. Democrats hold the numbers in the chamber. From here, the charge will go to the Senate. To convict the president, a two-thirds majority is needed. It's likely to hit the floor of the upper chamber on the eve of Joe Biden's inauguration. Firmly cementing Donald Trump's legacy will extend well beyond his term in the Oval Office. This is Catherine Diss in Washington, reporting for AM.
Amid the political turmoil in the US, the country has recorded its deadliest day of the pandemic. 4,327 people died yesterday, and caseloads continue to soar, as Sarah Seggie reports.
With close to 23 million cases and nearing 400,000 deaths, the US is by far the worst affected country in this pandemic. And now another bleak milestone. Michelle Mello is a professor of medicine at Stanford University in California.
Well, I think we've got the convergence of two different things happening just at the moment. One is a spike in cases due to most likely travel and gatherings over the Christmas and New Year holidays here. We know that a lot of people declined the many exhortations they received from public health officials to stay home and stay safe during the holidays. The second stream of problems here is our longer standing and very broad resistance among a big swath of the public to sensible community mitigation measures, especially masking and social distancing.
Is there any sense that things could actually get worse before they get better? Because there are projections that January is on track to be the deadliest month in the pandemic.
Those projections are things that I have seen too in modeling. You know, we have to be cognizant that some of the indicators of how quote unquote bad things are lagging indicators, meaning they show up after a period of time. So the first thing that we see is a change in the number of cases detected and the test positivity rate. Then about a week to 10 days later, we can expect to see a spike in hospitalizations, and another week or so later, a spike in deaths. So it's now, almost 2 weeks after the new year. We're into that second and third spike, but we're not through it yet.
In her home state of California, hospitals are struggling. It has more patients being treated for COVID than anywhere else in the country.
It's a very difficult situation. In the southern and more rural parts of the state, it has just been spreading like wildfire, and the providers are close to being completely overwhelmed.
The country's vaccine program is expanding to cover over 65s and people with certain comorbidities. But there are problems in getting it to everyone who needs it urgently.
The vaccine isn't helping yet. The only individuals to receive the vaccine so far in the overwhelming number of states here are healthcare workers. So until our vaccination program permeates a larger swath of the population, we're not likely to see a reduction in cases, much less hospitalizations and deaths. And while it's true that the administration today indicated it would like all Americans over age 65 to receive the vaccine, we are a long way from being able to make that happen.
And from the World Health Organization, another dire warning. This year could be even worse than the last as the health crisis continues. Dr. Mike Ryan is the executive director of the WHO's Health Emergencies Program.
Could even be tougher given the transmission dynamics and some of the issues that we're seeing. So we need to, really focus on looking at what's worked and then transferring that knowledge.
Dr. Mike Ryan from the WHO, ending Sarah Seggie's report. Well, the UK has recorded its deadliest day during the pandemic, with more than 1,500 people losing their lives to COVID-19. It comes as the British Prime Minister performed another U-turn, this time conceding 24-hour, seven-day-a-week vaccination centres are needed and will open as soon as possible. Europe correspondent Samantha Hawley reports.
In the House of Commons, Boris Johnson delivered some good news. The lockdown, at last, is starting to do what it's designed to.
The lockdown measures that we have in place, combined with the Tier 4 measures that we were using, are starting to show signs of some effect.
But still, tens of thousands of people are being infected every day, and the death toll is playing catch-up. It'll be weeks before it drops. The highest daily toll has now been recorded, 10 months since the pandemic hit the UK. And now there's been another change in policy from the British Prime Minister, who had been cool about the idea of 24/7 vaccination centres, but now concedes they're needed.
We'll be going to 24/7 as soon as we can, and my rival friend, the Health Secretary, will be setting out more about that in due course.
The government says it's on track to meet its target, vaccinating more than 14 million of the most vulnerable Brits by the middle of next month. But scientists like Professor Daniel Altman, an immunologist at Imperial College London, are concerned about the British government's decision late last year to delay the rollout of the required second dose of the vaccines for up to 12 weeks.
And I've got some sympathy with their view that sometimes in battle you have to take drastic choices. Many, many other people really don't agree with that. All of our assurances are based on those protocols. So how on earth can we guess or mix and match or just take a punt and say we think it'll be okay?
Lawrence Young from the University of Warwick Medical School is also concerned by the delay, particularly of the Pfizer vaccine, with the second dose recommended within 21 days.
My concern is that we just don't know what a longer gap will do, particularly because these RNA vaccines are very new technology.
There are some people lucky enough to have dodged the government's change in policy, including the British leader's own father, Stanley Johnson, who received his second Pfizer shot almost a week ago.
What a great news we have, and that is that the UK is moving rapidly, which is fantastic.
Hospital admissions in London are starting to fall for the first time since Christmas. But the government says it has no plans to lift any restrictions. This is Samantha Hawley in London, reporting for AN.
A team of 10 international experts from the World Health Organization will fly into the Chinese city of Wuhan in the coming hours for a long-awaited investigation into the origins of coronavirus. Among them is one Australian virologist who admits they're not going to find patient zero, but hopes some answers will help prevent another devastating pandemic occurring in the future. Here's China correspondent Bill Birtles.
Packing your bags and flying abroad to do 2 weeks quarantine, 2 weeks on the ground, and then another fortnight in hotel isolation when you get back is a tough trip. But for Sydney-based virologist Dominic Dwyer, it's a journey he's keen to make.
Clearly it's a commitment to go. Then again, I'm a virologist, so if I'm not excited about trying to investigate pandemics, then, you know, there's not much that's going to excite me.
Dr. Dwyer flew from Sydney to Singapore last night, where the other 9 members of the World Health Organization team will gather before an early morning flight to the Chinese city of Wuhan this morning. More than a year after the global pandemic started there, and 8 months after China agreed to let a WHO team in, Dr. Dwyer and his colleagues are finally arriving.
Look, we're not going to find patient zero or virus zero, but we may have a much better indication of, did the virus truly start in Wuhan? Did it start somewhere else but was amplified in Wuhan? Did it come from an animal source? And if so, which one? You know, what were the roles of laboratories in all of this?
He says the first 2 weeks of hotel quarantine in Wuhan won't be wasted, with Zoom calls and plenty of research already conducted by the Chinese scientists for the experts to go through. Then they may visit the wholesale seafood and animal market where an early cluster of patients was linked to. Dr. Dwyer says he hopes to also visit the Wuhan Institute of Virology and hospitals that treated the first patients.
The Chinese authorities have told WHO that they're happy for people to go where they feel they need to go.
China is very much in control of this investigation. Tight government restrictions have limited what research Chinese scientists have been allowed to publish about the virus so far. Any adverse findings about how Chinese authorities responded will likely be subject to political pressure, given that it's a joint investigation with China's government. For Australia, there's more riding on this investigation than for most other countries. China was furious about the Australian government's original call for an independent inquiry. It was one factor in Beijing's series of trade bans and restrictions on Australian exports. After all that diplomatic blowback, the Morrison government must surely be hoping this inquiry turns up some answers. This is Bill Birtles reporting for AM.
In Queensland, it's still a mystery about how a highly contagious UK strain of coronavirus escaped controls at a quarantine hotel in Brisbane. 4 returned travellers, a cleaner and her partner, are infected. And now more than 600 staff, guests and former guests are being asked to quarantine for a fortnight. Annie Guest reports from Brisbane.
32-year-old Dr. Umar Asan and his wife were one floor above the outbreak. On the eve of finishing a fortnight's quarantine, they learned it would double.
Not convenient and, you know, devastated. It's really bad.
He'd returned from working in the United States, where he found isolating in an apartment easier than hotel confinement.
Maybe they could allow the people who already completed the quarantine and then they self-isolate in the home.
They're among 129 guests restarting quarantine in a different hotel. More than 250 others who'd left the Hotel Grand Chancellor since December the 30th are also required to quarantine again, including some interstate. 226 staff are being asked to quarantine. Queensland's Chief Health Officer has described as an epidemiological mystery the cluster of cases of the COVID UK strain, which includes four guests, a cleaner and her partner. Dr. Umar Asan, who's a plant molecular biologist, did not see any infection control breaches.
I think they are following, like, okay.
And when people come to clean the room, what happens then?
No. Nobody come inside the room. Except, you know, when we got tested, that also happened on the door.
The doorway. And so
nobody was inside in our room for the last 14 days except us.
And your meals are left at the door?
Yeah, so they left a meal on the door and then they knock. And then, you know, we mask up and then grab the food in 15 seconds.
Queensland's Premier Anastasia Palaszczuk has called for National Cabinet to review hotel quarantine arrangements as police and health authorities investigate the outbreak. Professor Nigel McMillan from the Menzies Institute doubts air conditioners are to blame.
You're kind of left with the idea that there's something perhaps going on with the way that the quarantine's being run on that particular floor. And this particular virus strain being so infectious has somehow managed to breach the normal practices that have served us so well in the last few months.
My understanding is that the hotel quarantine staff have surgical masks. Should they have N95 or P2 masks, the better masks?
I would suggest that, you know, in the light of this, that they perhaps reconsider the use of masks in some of those actual room areas where they're cleaning.
Professor Nigel McMillan from the Menzies Health Institute, ending that report from Annie Guest. Meanwhile, the Queensland government is not confirming reports that it's now considering sending international travellers to remote worker camps in the state's gas fields. But the New South Wales Premier Gladys Berejiklian says that method of quarantine could have its own pitfalls.
We know that transmissibility or the contagiousness of the virus goes up in smaller vehicles. So when you're actually transporting people, when you're travelling those longer distances and spending longer time in close confines, it actually increases the likelihood of the spread of the virus. So whilst it might sound good in theory, we do need to take the health advice on that. Unfortunately, the health consequences could actually be worse.
New South Wales Premier Gladys Berejiklian. Desperate families are pleading with the federal government to grant their long-term visas while they're in Australia, instead of insisting that they leave the country during a pandemic if they want the visa activated. One of the main groups affected by this is parents who want to join their adult children in Australia. Federal Labor is introducing a private members bill next month to try to address this situation, as Dan Conifer reports.
When Trevor Tellett was told last year the parent visa he'd applied for was almost ready, he was elated.
We were finally getting our wish to be here in this great country with our children and grandchildren.
Originally from the United Kingdom, the 69-year-old and his wife Sandra have been living in Australia while waiting for their parent visas to be approved. Now, what seemed like a small hurdle before the pandemic is now a daunting one. Their visa category requires them to be outside Australia when it's granted.
Firstly, you've got the worry of the COVID situation. And secondly, you've got the worry of being stranded somewhere else. And then obviously we would have to come back in and quarantine with the cost and the expense and the trauma that involves when we're actually here safe and sound now.
Adding to the stress, he says, is the message he's received during dealings with the department.
There's an insinuation that if we don't comply, they could withdraw the visa.
Federal Labor MP Julian Hill says the situation is bewildering when the government is otherwise discouraging all but the most essential international travel.
The minister needs to change this rule and change it now.
Show some common sense.
In a statement, the Home Affairs Department says parents are being given additional time to leave Australia and are being advised of temporary visa options. But when Parliament returns next month, Julian Hill is planning to introduce a private members bill that would allow the Immigration Minister to issue any visa onshore during the pandemic.
How would we feel if it was our parent who we were farewelling at the airport next week to fly to the United Kingdom and hope to God that they don't get COVID and die?
The bill is unlikely to pass, but it does increase pressure on the government over the issue. Under fire last year, it announced other family visas, including for the children and partners of Australians, could be granted to applicants inside Australia. But it didn't extend the concession to parents.
I don't understand why they want us to risk our lives to go to the hotspots.
Gold Coast resort manager Tian Tiao appreciates the help of his Chinese mother as they care for his five-year-old son, Yilun, who lives with autism. The 61-year-old has also moved to the final stage of her application, but with limited English language skills, Tian says he would need to travel with her. Tian says his boy would be traumatised by the trip and weeks of quarantine, while as a single dad, he also wouldn't be able to leave his son behind.
My son is autistic and we don't have anyone here that he's familiar with to trust being taken care of. So that's a dead end as well.
Gold Coast man Tian Chow ending that report from Dan Conifer. And just an update to our top story, the US House of Representatives has now reached enough votes to impeach Donald Trump. That makes him the first US president to be impeached for a second time. In a year like no other, global human rights organisation Human Rights Watch found 2020 was marked by a failure to address racial inequality and a pandemic that placed unprecedented restrictions on personal freedoms. In its annual review, the group has noted the absence of human rights protections under the Trump administration, as well as concerning abuses here in Australia, as Bridget Fitzgerald reports.
It was this time last week that Donald Trump's supporters stormed the Capitol building and temporarily disrupted the final certification process of a free and fair election. The violent scenes shocked many, but Human Rights Watch Executive Director Ken Roth says the incident shouldn't have come as a surprise.
Donald Trump was a disaster for human rights. His flouting of human rights at home and his embrace of friendly autocrats around the world severely eroded U.S. credibility on human rights.
Speaking from Geneva for the launch of the Human Rights Watch World Report 2021, Ken Roth says the U.S. is at a pivotal moment to reset the agenda on global human rights and that the Biden administration must start by allowing justice to take its course.
The president shouldn't order prosecution. He should just let the professionals do what they do, to examine the evidence and to prosecute any crimes they find that Trump or his enablers have committed. And certainly that would include looking at Trump's encouragement of a mob, including many white supremacists, to attack the Capitol just last week, as well as his recent call to Georgia election officials asking them to find 11,000 more votes.
While the US is clearly dealing with serious problems of its own, the report highlights multiple failures in Australia's human rights performance too.
Australian Special Forces allegedly committed 39 unlawful killings in Afghanistan.
The lockdown successfully stopped the spread of the virus at the towers. But in my opinion, the immediacy of it was not compatible with the residents' human rights.
It's seen an escalation in the social indicators that diminish First Nations people.
Elaine Pearson is the organisation's Australian director.
The major human rights issues in Australia throughout 2020, firstly, was the continued failure to address long-standing abuses faced by First Nations people in this country. Given that this is a year when, you know, it will be the 30th anniversary of the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody, really we should be looking at, you know, why there have been these systemic failures in the first place. The other issues that we look at are the continued abuses against asylum seekers.
Those problems identified by Human Rights Watch include some restrictions on freedoms, particularly the lockdown of public housing towers in Melbourne during the height of the city's second wave and the closing of international borders.
Bridget Fitzgerald reporting. And that is AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Kim Landers.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.